Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how stevia, that wonderful natural herbal sweetener, can combat Lyme's disease, new research from the University of New Haven. We're also going to discuss how children learn better when they can move around a classroom from the National Association of Physical Literacy, and how Alzheimer's disease is linked to fat metabolism malfunction, King's College London, and also how inactive teens develop lazy bones, University of British Columbia, and a lot more. Also, our audio clips today, we're going to talk about the West was built on racism. It's time we faced it. Then, the left is no longer liberal. And also today, time permitting, since we seem to love war, Democrats and Republicans, Clintons, Obamas, wow. We're all over the world bombing every single day. We're killing someone. Of course, that's part of our exceptionalism. We are never held accountable to anyone because at this moment, there's no one to hold us accountable. So I'm going to have George Carlin speak truth to power. So George Carlin on war today. And an 86-year-old man sells his house to pay the village in which he lives a painting bill. Now, how's that work? You won't believe it until you hear it, but you will. I'm going to continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series today with Professor Jules Pretty. Professor Pretty, P-R-E-T-T-Y, is the Deputy Vice Chancellor at the University of Essex in the United Kingdom and a professor in the university's Environmental and Social Department, where he specializes in sustainable agriculture on the health benefits of exposure to nature and the environment. And we're going to talk about a manifesto for a green mind, a look at our civilization's alienation from nature and its consequences, and the neuroscience benefits of learning to cooperate with nature and environmentalism. Also today, in alignment with that, I'm going to look at three issues involving our environment today. The release of Arctic methane, quote, ready for this, may be apocalyptic. Now, who's saying that? Some conspiracy nut? No, one of the most respected environmental groups in the world. They're not saying it's bad. They're not saying it's terrible. They're saying it's apocalyptic. Also separately, the world's Great Barrier Reefs are damaged beyond repair. Climate News Network, Tim Radford. And the oceans are dying. Marine and animal life die-offs. And we're going to focus upon the California coast. From Max Slavo with the SHTF plan. Very, very important for all the thousands of people listening from California. When you look out at the ocean, you're not aware of it, but you're looking at a watery desert. Everything is dying off. And I'll get very specific and show you details of everything out there is just dead. How'd that happen? Well, we'll talk about it. So you see, we've got one very packed show today. I will not have time today to go to our talk back, but I'm setting aside one whole day next week just to do that. We begin always with the latest on health and healing. Now, a recent study indicates that stevia is more effective at combating Lyme's disease than antibiotics. You heard me right. The study's results were recently published in the European Journal of Microbiology and Immunology. Lyme's disease, as we know, is particularly challenging to treat as it shape shifts in quite a frustrating manner. Traditional antibiotics are not guaranteed to generate a lasting effect. And in comes stevia, S-T-E-V-I-A. This natural plant just might be a more effective and safer way to treat Lyme's disease than conventional antibiotics and other treatments. Now, this is according to the University of New Haven. Quote, a preclinical study conducted by academics at the University of New Haven's Department of Biology and Environmental Sciences shows that stevia leaf extracts boost strong antibiotic activity against the pathogen known as Borrelia. This is the pathogen responsible for the onset of Lyme's disease. Quote, the study determined that stevia whole leaf extract proved effective against all known varieties of the Borrelia. Well, the CDC has determined that a minimum of 300,000 individuals are affected by Lyme's disease every year. Now, antibiotics are currently used to treat the malady in orthodoxy. I have a different approach. And so now we know that there's another treatment. So I want people to know that. Also, kids learn better when they can move around to class. I might also mention that kids learn better when they're given recess where they can go out and yell and scream and play and jump and fall down and be kids. This is from the National Association for Physical Literacy. Now, for most kids, the average school day can be broken down into chunks of movement and sitting still. Recess, well, time to run around. Gym class, the same. All other classes, feet on the floor, butt in the chair, and try not to fidget too much. It's distracting to the teacher, and you might get diagnosed. Well, no. You will get diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, and you'll be put on a drug. But as the New York Times explains today, a growing number of education experts are arguing that the typical system is too siloed. Kids should really be moving constantly, even especially when they're learning. It's not just for the health benefits either. A more active student, the thinking goes, is also a better student. Quote, kids aren't meant to sit all day and take in information. That's according to Stephen Boyle of the National Association for Physical Literacy. His organization has developed a collection of short videos called brain energizers that lead kids through quick bursts of physical activity, providing opportunities to breathe, relax, recharge, and refocus. And that makes all the difference in the world. So what's it come down to? It comes down to this. Research suggests they may be on to something with their efforts. As science has previously noted, exercise can act as a memory boost. And a study published last year in Pediatrics found that allowing time for physical activity during lessons helped elementary school students to do better in both math and language lessons on average. Those in the movement group were roughly 4 months ahead of the control group in their learning by the end of the two-year experiment. So those activity bursts don't have to take time away from class either. And we know that, you know, you can incorporate this even in the classroom. I have suggested a lot that one of the best ways of creating is to go for a long walk as fast as you can and start thinking. And you'll find that your mind really races forward with all kinds of wonderful ideas. So the physical activity is liberating to the creative activity. And that is very important. In fact, a buddy of mine, who was a nationally ranked athlete, we would go out for long workouts, depending upon what we were training for, but more often than not, it was a marathon. So we would do, it was not uncommon for us to do a 20-mile workout on the track or on the road, then to go in and do another 2 hours in a gym. And during that period of time, we'd be talking. And what he told me, and I didn't pay attention to it at the time, its significance, but since then, I've seen this over and over again, is, in fact, I actually tried this with some people who were losing their memory. I had them walk around a given area. It might be a track at a high school. And after they walk for 4 laps, they're to stop and read one page, just one page of a book, something motivational. And then walk again, another 4 laps, stop and read another page. Walk 4 laps, stop, read another page. And they have a far higher retention because I told them now during the 4 laps where you're walking, after you read something, process it. How does what you just read relate to you? What can you learn from that? Now you're going to give a speech about what you just learned and its deeper implications. So now they're using that mile to get their mind working, and versus having someone just sit, read the same amount of pages, then the next day repeat what they learned. Like it was 90% forgotten what a person learned, some vague idea. Whereas when they were exercising, stopping, remembering, and then focusing, much better. So even when I'm asking people I'm working with to watch a self-empowerment documentary, might be an hour and a half, 2 hours long. I say, watch 15 minutes, no more. Have a stopwatch, 15 minutes. Stop, and then for the next hour, go for a walk and think about what you've just seen and how does it relate to you. So could you imagine us doing that in classes? That would help children tremendously. A new study from King's College London showed that the metabolism, meaning how your brain actually utilizes the omega-3 and omega-6 unsaturated fatty acids, is linked with the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And according to the latest study, certain types of fat exhibit specific trends in the brains of Alzheimer's disease patients, specifically faults in how unsaturated fatty acids metabolized may play a role in driving Alzheimer's disease progression. And these results provide further evidence for the metabolic basis for Alzheimer's. Quote, while this is a small study, our results show a potentially crucial and unexplained role for fats in the onset of dementia. Most surprisingly, we found that a supposedly beneficial omega-3 fatty acid actually increased with the progression of the disease. Okay, here's my take on this. I believe that we take in way too much of the omega-6 and the omega-9 fatty acids and way too little of the omega-3. I also believe that we should be taking curcumin and vitamin C at the same time that we take the omega-3 fatty acids because one acts as a carrier. Also, the idea that you just take one nutrient that's good for you, there's 1,000 studies on its benefit, but otherwise you're not changing anything. Oh, I did my health thing, Gary. I took some vitamin C this morning. Are you still drinking coffee, eating bagels, bacon and eggs? Yeah, but I took my vitamin C. Then it's not going to really make a difference. I base it upon what I call the laws of compensation, which mean, and some of you have heard me say this many times, that to the degree that you have any imbalance, any, no matter what the cause, epigenetic, meaning from your past, traumas, injury, genetic predisposition, nutritional deficiencies, anything and everything that could have caused you to have a disease process, you must actually exceed the energy of the disease process with the energy of a healing process. So it's not just how much of something you take. It is the completeness of the entire energy profile that causes the body to then have a new dominant energy, which is a healing energy, and a subordinate energy, which is a disease energy. And that's how I've seen some people just in a very short period of time. I've had as little as a week when people went from a major disease energy to a major healing energy, and the body responds appropriately. And the key is not doing it episodically, not doing it monotheistically, doing it completely. And hence, I believe in being in an environment away from all distractions, cell phones, negative people, no toxins, where you can give yourself the chance to heal. And that's when then the shift comes. But remember, we're nothing if not resistors. Most people's biggest problem is not their lack of awareness of what to do for their health. It's resisting it. We resist good advice. We resist making changes we know, both through common sense and intuition and logic, are in our best interest. We still resist. It's not because we're addicted. That's merely a secondary factor. It's because of the conditioning. We have mastered the art of resistance. So whatever you've mastered, that's your dominant energy. So if you've mastered the art of dominance to the no, then you have completely subverted the power of yes. Well, in my world, everything is yes. Let's get it done. Now, not tomorrow, not a little bit. You want to clean out that house? We'll do it in an hour. No, wrong. No, I'm being way too conservative. We'll do it in 15 minutes. I don't care how big the house is. I got two pieces of tape. One yellow, it stays. One red, it goes. And we're going to go through this house and real quick, without any emotion attached. Oh, but I remember it was, 22 years ago, and I got that postcard. And no, it's either it's part of your life because it's essential going forward, but it is irrelevant what it was in your life in the past. So if you don't need it, you got three boxes. One box is for the clothes you need, one box is for the furniture you need, and one box of personal items like computers and toothbrushes you need. And that's it. Nothing else you need. It gets the red. You put a red piece of tape on it. Then you walk out and hire someone to come in and throw it away. Give it away. Give it to Goodwill or someplace or some charity. Or throw it away. And now that's how it's done when it's yes. But if it's resistant, oh, I'm trying to throw it away. I'm metaphorically, I'm a part of my clutter because I'm hiding in, no, it's all nonsense. It's you've mastered the wrong energy. And whatever energy you master, even if no one else is aware of it, you're not going to change. No matter what the benefit would be, you're going to find 10,001 reasons not to change. I'd love to change, but I got this crisis and I got that crisis. I'm expecting another crisis, and beyond that crisis, I'll make up a crisis and you'll give me your crisis and I'll take yours and you'll rescue me, but I won't want to be rescued, but I'll pretend I do. And then when you try to rescue me, Tom and some of the other people wasted your entire lives trying to rescue people that never got rescued. You play the game, they play the game. You end up broke, you end up obese, you end up with heart disease, you end up near death, you almost died on a table, and you're still back at it. You've learned nothing. Guess who might be the next person to die this year? Wow, how dumb are the people I know when it comes to not understanding that unless you change completely the energy that you wake up with each day and make it a yes, I am doing it all, then it's just a game and you will lose. And loss may be bankruptcy, divorce, death, heart attack. You will be rewarded. Remember, nobody gets out of life without a reward for what they put into it. We just don't always like the rewards. But remember this, it's the laws of compensation. You must be able to master the energy of healing to subordinate all energies of diseasing. So the idea of just taking a supplement but not changing the energy, it's not going to work. Now, finally today, inactive teens, which are probably 80%, develop lazy bones. This is according to University of British Columbia. What do I mean? I mean this. Inactive teens, mind you, those are the ones who, it's kind of interesting. They are able to walk down the street and keep their eyes constantly on their little devices and thumbing. When they're in any environment, they're distracted by their portable devices. They're watching television. They're on their computer. They're inactive. They're just sedentary. That weakens the bones. And researchers at the UBC and the Center for Hip Health and Mobility in Vancouver measured this and found out that teenagers over a four-year period were able to create very unhealthy bone structures. They're going to be very susceptible early in life to fractures. Could you imagine teenagers with osteoporosis? Because they don't exercise. That's what it comes down to. It's that simple. So that's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I want to mention that we should pay attention to our environment because we're going to be losing major sections of it. But unless we live exactly where there is a crisis, we generally tend to deny its significance, that it's not going to happen to us, and certainly not now. Just the opposite. It's happening now, has been happening. And if you've been lucky not to live where you've had a natural disaster, well, that's about to change. This is just one of the reports, and there are many. We're talking about dozens of reports. And this is from Max Slavin. It's about the oceans. And there was an article published in Global Research. It talked about the ocean is dying. And that's by all accounts. With that goes much of the food supply for about 1 billion people and all the creatures in the ocean. Now, the causes are numerous. It's not just one thing, and they're often overlapping. The massive numbers of wild animal populations are dying as a result of it. Natural causes of the environment are partly to blame. So, too, are the corporations, the effects of Fukushima, the unleashing of untold levels of radiation into the ocean and onto the Pacific shores, the cumulative effects of modern chemicals and agricultural waste tainting the water and disrupting reproduction. And a startling new report says in no uncertain terms that the Pacific Ocean off California coast is turning into a desert. Now, once full of life, it is now becoming barren. The marine mammals, seabirds, and fish are starving to death as a result. Quote from Ocean Health. The waters of the Pacific off the coast of California are clear, shimmering blue today, so transparent it's possible to see the sandy bottom below. Clear water is a sign that the ocean is turning into a desert, and the chain reaction that causes that bitter clarity is perhaps most obvious on the beaches of the Golden State, where thousands of emaciated sea lion pups are stranded. Over the last 3 years, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has noticed a growing number of strandings on the beaches of California and up the Pacific Northwest. 1,171 sea lions were stranded in just one area. 2,700 had already been stranded the year before, a sign that something is seriously wrong, because the pups normally wind up dying. Quote, an unusually large number of sea lions stranded was a red flag that is a food availability problem even before the ocean got warm. This has never happened before. It's incredible. It's so unusual, and there's no really good explanation for it. There's also a good chance that the problem will continue. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration research scientist in climatology, Nate Mantua. And the problem is that the ocean is warmed 3 to 6 degrees normal than average. And that kills off the fish like the market squid and the sardines and the anchovies that the sea lions use for food. So the mothers of the sea lions are abandoning their pups for up to 8 days at a time in search of food. The pups are weaning themselves out because they're desperate. They have no food, and they're still babies, so they go into the water to try to hunt, and then they are themselves eaten by sharks or they die. Because when the mother comes back, the pup didn't know where to come back to. So we're talking about a massive, not a little, massive death. Quote, these animals are coming in really desperate. They're at the end of their life. They're in a crisis, and not all animals are going to make it. That's according to one of the things. They managed to rescue 115 sea lion pups. That's just a drop in the bucket. So that means that there are hundreds of thousands. Quote, we are talking about 50 to 100,000 deaths. Quote, this is massive, massive, unprecedented. It's according to University of Washington seabird ecologist who oversees the coastal observation and seabird survey team. So you have hundreds of thousands of birds dying just in one area. You have tens of thousands of mammals, sea mammals dying. Not a single word about it anywhere. All right, in the media, like, who cares? Well, you should. Also, the world's reefs are dying. This is from Tim Radford from Climate News Network. Quote, Australia's Great Barrier Reef and reefs in the Maldives have been dangerously weakened by coral bleaching caused by global warming and El Niño events. The Great Barrier Reef, by the way, is one of the wonders of the Pacific Ocean, and it will never recover from the combined effects of global warming and El Niño. Now, why should you care? Because as these reefs die off, the hundreds of millions of tiny fish that eat on them will die, and then the larger fish that eat on them will die, and the larger fish that eat on them will die. You have just a cumulative death. And why? Hotter oceans. The oceans are becoming hotter. Global warming is driving greenhouse gas concentrations, and that is causing this. And our final report is from Dar Jamal from Truthout. Release of Arctic methane, quote, may be apocalyptic. Now, you haven't heard this before. I thought this would be of interest. And it's a scientific study published in the prestigious journal Paleo World, and it issued a dire and, from my perspective, possibly prophetic warning, though it garnered virtually no attention in the media. Quote, global warming triggered by massive release of carbon dioxide may be catastrophic, but the release of methane from hydrate may be apocalyptic. The study titled Methane Hydrate, Killer Cause of Earth's Greatest Mass Extinction, highlights the fact that the most significant variable in the Permian mass extinction event, which occurred 250 million years ago and annihilated 90% of all the species on the planet, was methane hydrate. In the wake of that mass extinction event, less than 5% of the animal species on the planet and in the seas lived, and less than one-third of the large land animal species made it. Nearly all of the trees died. What is it? Methane hydrate. This is according to the Office of Fossil Energy. Quote, is a cage-like lattice of ice inside of which are trapped molecules of methane, the chief constituent of natural gas, end quote. So we should be very aware that as the Arctic warms, and it is, as the tundras of Russia, the boreal forest, Norway, Sweden, as those great areas of ground that have been frozen for tens of thousands of years, as they thaw, which they are, methane is coming out, and methane is far more of a contributor to global warming than, let's say, CO2. So it's upon us. But no one's paying attention in the mainstream media. And as a result, citizens are not being informed. And because no governor wants to say our state is in a crisis, we suggest a appropriate and proper program to help relocate people to places that would not be adversely affected. People are just sitting on the deck of the Titanic. That's how bad it is. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to our guests in just a moment here. I just want to mention my concern for a sustainable environment and my concern for telling the truth about how bad it really is when it comes to unique environmental effects and also all of the different feedback loops and tipping points that the mainstream media is not paying attention to. The mainstream media will only give a day or two to a particular event, like 7 months ago when Louisiana had the once-in-a-500-year flooding in one parish. A parish is the same as a county. 63,000 homes were damaged or destroyed. The problem is they had no flood insurance because it had never flooded in those parishes. As a result, those people had no homes to go back to. Mold was so massive that they could not go back in for health reasons, so they couldn't get rebuilding certificates, and they had no money to rebuild. Well, what happened to all those people? Let's say you have four people per home and you got 63,000 homes. You've got hundreds of thousands of people who have, in effect, no place to go. Yet it's no longer in the news. It stopped after a few days. And when the rain stopped and the flooding stopped, it stopped. What about the worst flooding in Wisconsin's history, Virginia's history, West Virginia's history, Vermont's history, all in the last 12 months? How could you have seven once-in-500-year events all within 9 months of each other, and no one say, wow, shouldn't we begin to understand this, what we can do to help prevent it, and what we can do to survive it? So what I'm going to do is on Sunday evening, 8 p.m., April 2nd, Eastern Standard Time, I'm going to do a 2 to 3 hour webinar. First, I'm going to show my new film, Saving the Planet, which, by the way, just today, I was informed, I'm out on the road, but I was just informed that we won a biggie. I'll find it here in a moment. Right here it is. It's we won International Independent Film Awards, Saving the Planet, platinum winner for this year. That's the 27th award, by the way, for Plant Coaster, Saving the Planet, two different films since January. So we're happy about that. It means that people are paying attention, at least the people in the festivals. So I'm going to show that, but then I'm going to do a 1 to 2 hour discussion on how to appropriately and properly prepare yourself for the future. Eco villages, best places to live. Where are there sustainable resources? Where are the places least likely to be adversely affected by tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, fires? We had 36,000 extreme fires in the last 12 months in the United States. You don't want to be in a place like Arizona that this year had the worst sandstorm in the country's history. It was 3 miles high and 6 miles long. Now, sandstorm is not a dust storm. Dust storms are bad. We had them for almost 10 years in the 1930s, all due to our own agricultural stupidity, a monoagriculture, and no cover crops in winter. But a sandstorm is different. You get a 30, 40 mile an hour sandstorm, it can do some serious damage to crops, to the paint on your car and house, and to you if you're out in it. And that is going to be a new norm. Flooding, 10 inches of water in Houston just about 3 weeks ago in 24 hours, the most in the city's history for one day. No one pays attention to it. 114,000 extreme weather events in the planet in the last 12 months, no one pays attention to it. Well, we are. I'm not talking about getting a bunker someplace. I'm talking about vitalism in the way that we, who are progressive-minded, want to spend the future where we're not irresponsible. We are wanting a quality of life, and we're using the time we have to be in the best place at the best time under the best circumstances. So it's a one-time-only lecture. You can go to my website, GaryNoll.com, or you can go to PRN.fm, that's PRN.fm, for more information on that. And again, I've got as wide a bandwidth as I can. Unfortunately, last time when I did this about 4 months ago, I didn't have enough. We've gone as much as we can to get as many people who want to be there, and I'll be taking calls from people as well. Now let's, we're going to go over in a second, speak with my guest, and who is standing by, and he is in the United Kingdom, and he's on Skype, Professor Jules Preti, and we're going to talk about a manifesto for a green mind. Please stay with us. Important interview coming right at you. Nice to have you with us, everyone, all over the world. We appreciate you being here. Now let's go over to Nayland Village in the United Kingdom. We're standing by as my guest, Professor Jules Preti. He is the Deputy Vice Chancellor at the University of Essex in the United Kingdom and a professor in the university's Environmental and Society Department, where he specializes in sustainable agriculture, the health benefits of exposure to nature, and the environmental crisis affecting Western civilization. He's a member of the university's Green Exercise Team that has been scientifically investigating nature's role in maintaining health. He's also a fellow of the British Society of Biology and the Royal Society of Arts. He belongs to numerous international organizations and boards, and he is also the author of Sustainable Agriculture and Food, as well as The Earth Only Endures, and his latest by Cornell University Press is The Edge of Extinction, Travels with Enduring People in Vanishing Lands, which took him around the world exploring communities living in cooperation with nature. His website is Jules, J-U-L-E-S, Preti, P-R-E-T-T-Y.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you, Gary. Thanks very much.
Your work came to my attention from a recent article published in the excellent British ecological and spiritual magazine, Resurgence, that attempts to define a reorientation of our Western way of thinking and relating to nature and our planet because of it's our lifestyle and habits and worldviews that are threatening our very existence today. And clearly in America, which pats itself on the back for its exceptionalism and its faux prowess, people are becoming less and less happy. And the most recent World Happiness Report, commissioned by the UN, found the U.S. dropping even further to 14th place among developed nations. And a main reason for this, according to Jeffrey Sachs, is because the sense of community in the United States is completely eroding. There is no longer sustainable social coherence in our population, but only fragmentation, competition, and classes between ideologies. And I'd also like you to look at the extraordinary ignorance and denial of this fact and its collective inability to face the real threats before us, such as climate change and global warming and food security and a nation living in a toxic stew of corporate greed. And we seem to be oblivious. And even when I went down to New York University and I went to Columbia University and Goddard College across the street from Columbia, and I simply outside with my camera go ask people. Now, mind you, these are students or faculty. I said, do you care about global warming? Most of the students and faculty said yes. I then ask them, what exactly are you doing specifically to contribute to lessening of that threat? I couldn't get anyone to say anything. It's as if, yeah, I'm aware of the problem. Yeah, it's bad. no, I'm not going to change anything, or I haven't done anything. So we're living in this cognitive disconnect. So could you address these, please? The forum is yours.
Certainly. It's a conundrum for us that in affluent countries, in the United Kingdom, in the US, on your side, over the past 50 years, we've all got an awful lot richer. As measured by GDP, we have 3 or 4 times more GDP per person than 50 years ago. And yet, over that same period, happiness has remained resolutely flat across the population, and as you've just said, maybe declining as well recently. Then that seems odd, because all of that stuff is supposed to make us happy, and it hasn't been. And actually, what has happened is that those consumption patterns, the way that we are consuming resources that are having an impact upon climate, having an impact upon the planet as a whole, those are the kind of side effects of those individual decisions that we've made over days and months and years, living the way that we do. So what we've tried to do is to say, if we could consume things that improved our well-being, consumed a view, a sunset, birdsong, sitting in the garden, talking to friends, and used our time in that kind of way, created community, just as you've said, you know what? Actually, there would be benefits for us in terms of our well-being. And at the same time, we might, little by little, help to save the planet. And the difficulty with this individual responsibility argument is that, of course, you've got to have a lot of people doing that to make a difference. And there are a lot of big structures and economic structures and forces across the world that are pushing us in another direction. But every little change has got to start in a small way. And really, our manifesto for the Green Mind was to make a suggestion that we can make a difference by getting close to nature, spending time in nature and getting a benefit from that, spending time with other people, the social benefits, and engaging in some kind of crafts or skill-based activities that make us feel better and pass time in a way that's low consumption. And I might mean embroidery or knitting or carpentry or gardening, or baking, for example, any of these sorts of things that involve some skill that takes a time to build up, actually, they give us a health benefit as well. So I think there's a starting point for your challenge in all of that.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. For the past 15 or more years, you and your colleagues at ESSEC have been researching the benefits of nature and what it provides for physical, mental health, and we might even include spiritual health, too. Everything about our technological age of electronics and virtual reality and life in the cities is moving further, further and further towards people being isolated and away from the very ground that is essential for living on Earth. Humans are more alienated from nature than, in my opinion, than ever before in westernized countries, and are becoming ever more alienated as the new commercial contraptions of virtual reality comes to market. So please summarize what you and your team have discovered about the scientific and health benefits of people reconnecting with nature or rewilding their minds, as it were. And second, in your estimation, how much of the epidemic of illnesses such as diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular disease and cancer and chronic fatigue and others might be, in part, attributed to our alienation from the environment and the natural resources, the natural plant-based diet, for example, and the lack of exposure to it. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'll come to that second question in a moment. What we found over 15 years' worth of research is activities in nature, sometimes very active, sometimes kind of relatively low physical activity, which we call green exercise, regardless of social group, age, gender, wealth, ethnic background, regardless of any differences between people, have an impact upon our well-being, both our mental and physical well-being. And we coined a term to say that if you go outside, you in the first 5 minutes, you get a dose of nature. So it's a kind of deliberate medicalization of the language here, to suggest that we can take a dose that will have a benefit to us across the whole of the day. If you do it often enough across the week, maybe very often enough across the whole of our life course. So it's not just a short-term benefit that disappears. It's something that can accrue and build up. So part of this is also the nature of how habits are formed and how you carry on doing things that are good for our well-being. Now, the link to the health, some of those health conditions that you've just talked about, they are very closely related to the way that we behave. And to a certain extent, you could say that affluence has betrayed us because we thought that it was going to bring us unending good, but it's also brought a whole range of bads as well. And we have learnt to behave in a kind of way, to live in a way in modern societies that results in us living a little bit on simmer. The kind of stresses and pressures of everyday life have an impact upon our well-being, which is a kind of echo of the fight and flight reactions that we would have had in distant evolutionary history, when to survive the potential predators, tigers or lions or something of that nature, then we were primed to run away very quickly if we saw a sign that there might be something there. And we got very good at it because we're still here today. But probably 99 times out of 100, there actually wasn't a tiger or a lion there. So we're primed to have a negativity bias. And in modern life, that negativity bias switches on the sympathetic nervous system. And if you do that too much, you're in this kind of fight or flight mode. And that may be switched on by a comment on the social media. It may be switched on by somebody trying to kind of jump in front of you when you're driving. The modern equivalents of this kind of negativity are widespread, and they have a direct effect upon our health, and they do provoke immune conditions, gastroenteritis conditions. They provoke cardiovascular disease. Type 2 diabetes is related to an overreaction of the sympathetic nervous system, and the other nervous system is the parasympathetic, and that's the rest and digest system. And what you get when you sit quietly in the park or in the garden or sit on a beach or sit and talk to friends is a high reaction of the parasympathetic nervous system, the calming rest and digest, and that's the one that keeps us healthy and with high well-being. So you can see a link to the inside stuff, the way our brain works, the way our endocrine systems work and our nervous systems work, and how that behavior that we have in the environment, it then shapes our well-being. And the link between the two is really very important. And a lot of people are walking into health problems because they don't quite realize them.
I would like you to extend your thoughts a little further, please, because I believe the green mind is not simply an imaginary term. You define this based upon neuroscience and what we know about the brain and its functionings. So go further, please, and speak about how our industrialized culture impacts our brain, whereby we become further removed from being rooted in relationship to the environment. And then what are the impacts upon our brains when we immerse ourselves in nature?
Yeah, well, what we've done is to use a metaphor for the brain and say, imagine it is divided into a red brain and a blue brain. And the red brain is the original brain, original in evolutionary terms, the ancient part of the brain, the first part. It's the driver of the fight and flight. It's the bit that kind of switches you on, drives the heart rate up, drives the breathing up, switches off your gut, switches off your immune system, because you don't need any of those when you're running away really quickly. The blue brain is what we call the more recent part, the rest and digest, the driver of the parasympathetic sympathetic nervous system, the thinking bit of the brain. And that is where we learn stuff. A good analogy here is actually learning to drive a motor car, an auto, is that when we start a habit, it's really difficult because you have to think about it an awful lot. And so you're using a lot of the blue brain. Once you habituate something, it gets sent down to the red brain and becomes, it takes less energy to keep reminding yourself as to how you carry on that habit. So what we know is that attentiveness and immersion in activity, if we think of those as kind of behavioral attributes, they're the ones that switch on the blue brain and actually suppress this trigger activity of a little bit in the middle of our brain called the amygdala. There's actually a couple of them, but we talk of them as in the singular. And the amygdala is the hair trigger. But if you have lots of blue brain activity, which is provoked by, as I've said, attentiveness to something, and nature is a really good example of something that works well, and immersion in something, so our kind of behavior, which could be a spiritual thing, it could be meditation, it could be mindfulness, it could be prayer, it could be Tai Chi or some yoga or some sort of activity, or indeed, it could be, as I said earlier, baking or some kind of craft activity where you become deeply immersed in it and you forget yourself, as it were, because you're concentrating on this activity. We know that that then releases serotonin, dopamine, other things that actually make us feel better. Make us well at the same time. So our notion of the green mind is that the right combination of mostly blue brain activity, a bit of red for excitement and activity, not too much red, that's a green mind that is going to keep us well and healthy for a very long time. And if you look at cultures across the world that have extreme longevity, where people live and very long time. If we take a couple of areas in Japan, in Nagano and Okinawa, very large numbers of people are centenarians. They live beyond 100 years. Numbers are increasing, of course, at the moment. And if you look at them and say, well, why are they doing that so well? There are five simple things. They have interesting, spicy, unusual food, which is important when you're older because your taste buds get shot. They engage with each other. There's lots of social interaction. They're physically active every day. They have close connections with nature, and they're cognitively engaged. They do interesting things. They have activities. They're learning all their life. And if you put those five things together, that's, in a sense, a manifesto for a green mind that will keep us going until we're 100 or more. And I think that's quite a decent proposition, actually.
I'd like for you to add something onto that based upon what a member of the British intelligentsia and creative community, George Bernard Shaw, said. He said, we have no more right to consume happiness without producing than if we consume wealth without producing it. And yet today we have an entire generation that believes that everything should be produced for it, the vast majority. And therefore there's little inclination to go into nature. They can get on one of their devices and bring nature anywhere in the world where you've actually been to them. They don't want to read a whole book. They rarely have an awareness of the classics, and they're functionally illiterate about everything. It's essential to a person understanding the world they live in. So on the one hand, we have conditioned, epigenetically conditioned a group of people that you don't have to go to the beach, you don't have to go to the mountains, you don't have to go to exotic places, you don't have to eat spicy foods. We'll show you a spicy food. We'll give you a virtual reality. You put it on, you look at it, and suddenly you have been there. You're like a modern version of a lazy Lowell Thomas. Now, that said, I want to go back to something you began by saying, where if we look at the association between the collapse of human community and positive social engagement with the rise in unhappiness, and even our sense of disconnect and insecurity, what are the adverse effects upon our mental and physical health when we are forced to become asocial and define ourselves upon material consumptions rather than social interactions? And you would know this in a unique way because in preparation for the edge of extinction, you traveled to the mountains of China and the Tuva in Siberia and Botswana and the Arctic and Australia and New Zealand and even in pockets of communities in UK and Canada and United States. And in all these communities, you observed the type of cooperation and coexistence between the population and the environment that, from my perspective, is absent in our civilization today. We don't want to coexist. We don't want to cooperate. We have been conditioned for competition, winner takes all. And nature is there to conquer and not to care about its despoiling. You've seen this up close. Tell us what you feel are the most important lessons for us that we might reflect upon or adapt from your findings.
I think that that's very wise. And what I would say is that the priority is almost certainly creating memories and experiences early in life, particularly in what are called the middle ages of childhood, between about 5 years old and 11, after the kind of early growth and the need for security, and when you start looking outwards into the world. Many people who feel strongly about the natural environment have early memories and early behaviors that they feel as though help to shape them. And you can see this working in communities. If we take our Tuvan communities in Siberia, nomadic people living in an area that's a 12th of the world's landmass, a vast grassland steppe. People are nomadic, moving four times a year, walking with heavy-headed Siberian horses. They pitch their yurts, and on every yurt, a solar panel so that they can charge their mobile phones and watch the TV. So what's kind of interesting is how you could put together the bits of the modern world that people actually want, and they want to use cell phones to be able to contact each other and to get the best of that. But they also want to live a daily close to the land in a way that helps to shape and celebrate their identity. So I think our challenge in affluent countries is obviously for all of us to spend more time in the outdoors. I think I would say that completely. But a real priority is to find ways to ensure that our schools have outdoor teaching, have gardens, that our homes for the elderly have places where they can go outdoors and also benefit, a garden, a place to engage, that in cities people have opportunities to go to parks. The largest park in central London, which will be on many people's minds at the moment, Hyde Park, has typically on a summer's evening 200,000 people in it. I bet Central Park has a similar kind of number. Lots of people vote with their feet. They may not quite realize what it is that they're doing, but their behavior shows that people still recognize somewhere the value of being in the natural environment and the health benefits they get from sitting, doing nothing. If you're on a beach and you look around you, you watch and you'll see that most people are really enjoying doing nothing. Yet when they're at home, they probably barely allow themselves to do that. And yet that's a great way to improve your well-being.
I thank you very much for your good work, including what I would recommend everyone read, The Edge of Extinction, Travels with Enduring People in Vanishing Lands. All the best to you, and we look forward to another conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
From Nayland Village in the United Kingdom, a Professor Jules Preddy, Deputy Vice Chancellor at the University of Essex, and one of the foremost professors in the world on environmental sustainability. I'm Gary Knoll. We're always seeking around the world people you have not heard to bring you voices of reason, and hopefully you enjoyed it. I have a lot more coming on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.